So we've been here together practicing for about one day. And I'd like to take a little time this evening to reflect on what it is that we're doing, what's been happening perhaps for us. And to perhaps reflect on how that relates to the theme of the retreat and the perhaps reason why we're here. I notice sometimes that I sit up or sit down and then the microphone doesn't move with me. So we just have to live with that because we have to live with this because it does things. See how it goes. Actually, having said that, I think I'll hold it for this. Yeah. Yeah, this is better for this, I think. So, returning. We spend a lot of time returning on a retreat. May not always feel like we're returning to the heart. Sometimes it feels like we're returning to something that feels a little more chaotic and confused. A little more fragmented and hard to comprehend. But nonetheless, in this process, in this practice of coming back again and again, we are learning what it means to come closer, to live more closely with what is really at the center of our life, to find the possibility of peace and freedom in the midst of all things, in the midst of all conditions. This is something for which our lives, or to which our lives call us. And so we might reflect, well, you know, here we are on retreat. What's happening? We sit, we walk, we stand, we engage in the forms. Essentially, we're exploring what it means to be a human being, to be this living, sensitive, conscious, well, sometimes conscious, existence. And it's not easy for us in many different ways. It can challenge us in useful ways, but not always comfortable ways. Some of the ways we're challenged is we're used to always doing something that we can measure the results of in order to let ourselves know we're doing okay. We tend to do this with our meditation, of course, as well. And yet the invitation, the encouragement is to not engage so much in that measuring, in that process. And some of the activities, in fact, make that a little difficult because they are quite obviously pointless. Walking back and forth. Did anyone have the thought at any point? I trust you did this, walking back and forth, at least some of the time. And have the thought, this doesn't really seem to be much use for anything. Why on earth am I doing this? And sometimes when we believe that thought, we might go and do something else, imagining that folding our socks or reading the notice board is actually something more useful. But there's something very useful about doing something that's actually useless. Because we start to, or we're invited to begin to explore what it means to be, to walk back and forth, and see that it produces nothing that we can market in a commercial environment, nothing we could sell in the marketplace. Nothing at all. Can't even impress our friends with the fact that we did something that simple and pointless, I suspect. Unless they've done it themselves, in which case they will be impressed to know that we did it too, because they will know it's not easy. Why on earth would we do something like this? Sitting around, walking back and forth, standing in one place for a while and then doing it all again. Why on earth would people like you and me have spent days and weeks and months and years throughout generations of human history doing this? Well, I think we all seek for a deeper connection with what is possible for us as human beings. We all seek for peace, for freedom, to awaken to what is possible. And often the way we imagine that will come about, of course, is that we want our mind to be quiet. We want the mental activity to come to an end. And I might have already mentioned this, but often we, despite hearing the instruction that says we're not trying to get rid of thinking, it's not about having a particular experience, we can still have a strong sense that actually we want the mind to be quiet. Did anyone notice that that was something they wished for today at any point? No? We want the mind to be quiet. Yeah. It's interesting. We don't necessarily recognize it, but incessant, out of control mental activity is painful. It just is. And even if we hadn't thought about it like that, we notice how disappointed we are when it doesn't stop as soon as we begin meditating. That's a little bit of a pointer to how much we'd like it to give us a break. It's sometimes painful, it's often frustrating, it's equally exhausting, it consumes a vast amount of energy. And it, as a process, that wishing for our mind to stop is an expression of and an illustration of one of the deeper patternings that can drive and dominate our lives. And we could describe it simply as the wish for things to be different than they are. How much we wish for this world, for the people around us, for ourselves, our bodies, our minds, to conform with what we wish for, or what we expect, what we feel would serve and support our well-being or our advancement in our spiritual development. Did anyone have a moment today where they thought they might perhaps prefer or even quite like it if the music would stop? One or two people mentioned to me. I had a moment or two like it as well. Did you notice yourself wishing so much that it would stop? That it sort of was as if you were trying to get it to happen by wishing for it? I remember once I went on retreat for a month in a cabin in the woods in France. And I went to France because in England, where I live, the weather is not reliably sunny in summer. And I wanted some sunny weather, I have to confess. So I went in June. It should be good in France, the south of France. Nice cabin in the woods. Some good friends nearby providing me meals. This must be a nice retreat. It rained almost every day, quite a lot. Somewhere about 2 weeks, I could have stayed in England for this, but somewhere 2 weeks into the retreat, I think, I was standing outside the little cabin and I noticed with my whole body, heart and mind, I was trying to get the rain to stop. It's like, ah! And it's kind of funny, isn't it? Because we know the rain isn't going to stop. It's a fact it's not going to be affected. Possibly, if we try hard enough, it might sort of evaporate the rain around us because we start to get angry and heat comes off us. But the rain's going to keep coming. This might be something you recognize in yourself at times. With our very own minds, we're sometimes wanting our mind to stop. And it's the mind of self, of course, that's wanting the mind to stop. We see what a problem it is if we recognize the very thing that wants it to stop is the thing that wants stopping. I don't know if I've said that right, but you get the sense. It's stuck to itself in the process of trying to get itself to stop. And the very wanting is part of what we want to release from. But it doesn't provide it. Likewise, the party. If we were to be wish for it to end and the sound to go away, it starts to become painful and distressing. And of course, it's a simple and quite clear example of how in our lives, in fact, in another situation, we might, if we were going to a party, quite like some music. It's not that the music is the problem, it's the sense that it's not supposed to be here. Not while I'm meditating, trying to be calm and peaceful and spiritual, and instead feeling distracted and irritated and definitely not very calm, and not particularly full of loving kindness either, in response to whoever's making that noise. Interesting, huh? How we do that. This life is as it is. We can, of course, have some influence upon many things, including our own experience, but we do not control it. It is not given to us to be able to determine what will happen or how it will feel for us when it does happen. And these two things, of course, are important to us. We care about what happens, and we care so deeply about how it feels for me when things happen. We really do. But because we care without necessarily understanding deeply the processes involved, we tend to respond from that caring by attempting to control in order to protect against that which we feel threatened by, in order to promote or enhance that which we feel supported by. In so many different ways we do this. But the way it plays out is a tendency to take hold of, to demand, to put pressure upon people, things, ourselves, to be in a certain way, to not be in a different way. And as a result of that pressure, our mind is often quite distressed and feels out of control. When we respond to that by trying to control it, adding pressure to an already pressurized system, it's perhaps obvious that this isn't really going to improve things. So we begin to learn to respond differently, to become aware, to be close to what's happening. Part of what happens here is we follow the instructions, at least some of the time, perhaps, I hope, when we engage in the meditation. We follow the instructions, and yet we find ourselves kind of interpreting them as if they mean that somehow we should quieten or stop this mind. And then we easily find ourselves in conflict with it. There's a saying that comes from India, I'm not sure what particular kind of thing is. It's like a saying. It goes like this. How do you fence in a rogue bull elephant? Of course, you see the problem. A rogue bull elephant can trample any fence you can build. How do you fence one in? The answer is so. You put it in a very large field. If it has enough space, it has no need to trample down the fence. With our mind actually giving it space, not license to do anything, but space, which means holding what we encounter there within a spacious relationship where we do not try and control it, but at the same time we do not tether ourselves to it and feel obliged to follow it. Often our sense is that either I have to go with this thing, my mental activity, or I have to stop it. It's like those are my two options. But in fact, it's not so. We can allow it to move, but not have to go with it. And this is part of what we learn as we orient our attention into the body, as we establish ourselves in something that isn't moving so much, so quickly, so frantically, and so fragmented and reactive patterns, as our mind often can be, particularly as we begin. We give it space, and we start to bring into the space of heart and mind qualities that can be supportive for this. I recently have had the real delight of walking on Dartmoor with a friend of mine who has just got a puppy. And Dartmoor is quite a beautiful open wild space in the area of England where I live. And my friend Bill has this puppy, Jago, which it's kind of a, I'm not quite sure what kind of dog, but it can run really fast. It's quite sort of swift and sleek. And it's young and full of energy. And when we go walking, sometimes it takes off and it's like it disappears in 2 moments. And my friend Billy's calling, hey, come back, come back. And sometimes it takes a little while before it comes back and we don't know what it's been up to. Hopefully nothing too bad. But what's interesting is whenever the puppy comes back, it's actually not so small now, 6 months old, he gives it a little treat. He says, good dog, for coming back. He doesn't give it a smack and say, bad dog, you ran away. He gives it a treat and says, good dog, you came back. Does this sound like anything you've noticed today? Because with our mind, and this is the wisdom of training a puppy, with our mind, if every time we notice it runs away, we give ourselves a smack for it. Oh, bad mind. That wasn't very meditative. Look where you went. You caused a lot of trouble. Actually, after a little while, the puppy mind starts to think, this guy's pretty unfriendly. I think I'm getting out of here as soon as I can. And it does. Whereas if every time you notice your mind has returned, it's like, oh, wow, I'm back. You know, it's really quite miraculous that you came back at all. Really. You know, by definition, you didn't do it. Because by definition, you weren't there. That's the whole point. When we're gone, we're not there. So somehow we come back. And that's, of course, connected with the underlying intention that we're establishing and practicing here. But it's also something quite miraculous, it seems to me. And if we see, whoa, somehow, you know, we were gone, we were lost, and then we rose, oh, I'm back. We could actually honor that. We could celebrate that. You know, we maybe don't need to give ourselves a piece of chocolate, but we could just say, oh, wonderful, you came back. And start to trust this capacity of coming back, to allow this to deepen. In that way, the puppy mind, which is learning, this is training, it takes time to do what we're doing. We spend all our life letting our mind run all over the place whenever it liked, thinking that's what was going to serve us. We train ourselves through our education mostly in how to absorb and manipulate information. It's not a training of the mind, it's a feeding of the mind. We end up with an overfed puppy. It's not a very happy one because it just keeps eating and eating and eating. So here we don't feed it so much and we give it some useful exercise. And of course, if you didn't do so much exercise in your life, it doesn't feel so easy to do it at first. But it starts to become easier and we realize we feel better for having done it. And if we keep doing it, actually, exercise becomes enjoyable while we do it. And makes us feel better. We know this about our bodies. The mind is the same. And so this puppy mind starts to realize this is kind of a friendly place here. This, the owner, this guy, that person, it's actually friendly. I think I'll hang around a bit more. We start to create an inviting, kindly, and yet supportive, which means with some framework of intentionality, some holding through our intentionality. This is actually a safe place. Just as we know children need a lot of kindness, but they also need some boundaries. They need to know where the lines are and say, okay, yeah, we don't do that. That's helpful. If we get it wrong, it doesn't help to punish them in any judgmental or aggressive way, but just to let them know, oh, look, this is what we're doing here. This is why we're doing it here. And our minds, if they've not been trained, are kind of like children. And you'll see your mind going, oh, you've had enough of this, I'm out of here. Plenty of times, as a child would, if you tried to get it to do some housework. You know, if it gets a chance, it wants to disappear. But as an adult, anyone who learned to do housework as a child will be grateful, because now they know how to do this rather useful, boring thing that actually makes your life a lot better. Of course, the meditation isn't always boring. There's a process of learning that takes place here in many different ways. And we find ourselves perhaps in the same place many times until we learn what we need to learn. This is the nature of all learning. One thing we need to do is give ourselves permission to get it wrong. We're here, I guess, because we don't yet know quite how to do this. And I'm not just talking about meditation. I'm talking about life. It doesn't come with an instruction book. Most of the people who turned up here with us actually don't know how to do it either. Not that well. I mean, look at what the heck's going on. Everyone wants to be happy and live together and care for each other in the world, but that's not what happens. Because there's reasons, because there's situations, because there's history. Of course, all that is there. But in our depths and our hearts, of course, what we want is peace and safety and coexistence and well-being. Of course, if we imagine our safety and our peace and our coexistence is dependent on or is in conflict with someone else's, then we have problem. We get into mine and yours, this and that. So we see that we have a lot to learn. We have a lot to learn. And the only way we can learn is if we give ourselves permission to make mistakes. This is how it is for children. Learning and playing involves being able to learn through making mistakes, and it doesn't matter. You get forgiven, you can try again. As adults, we sometimes make the mistake of thinking that because my body has finished growing, I have too, and I'm supposed to be grown up, you know, and therefore I need to know what I'm doing. And we have to at least pretend that we know, look like we know what we're doing, because everyone else is doing the same. But, you know, have you ever realized or noticed how a lot of the time I don't, you don't, we don't know what we're doing at all? We're trying to get by in a complex and yet not yet fully comprehended situation. So give yourself space here to make mistakes, to learn how to do it. Sure, we get it wrong. If you're not getting it wrong, it means you're not going beyond. It's not getting it wrong some of the time. It means you're not going beyond what you already know. If we gave you a practice, you could just sit down and do it straight away and it was easy. It might be fun. You might even feel better. But you wouldn't have to grow to be able to do it. Here, the practice is something that we can't do so easily, precisely because it requires us to expand, to develop, to learn. So two of the things that are essential really in terms of connecting, coming back in contact with what we could call the heart of our life, the depths of our being, the really foundation and basis for peace and freedom, is to do the best we can to not cause harm, to not do damage, and yet understand that we won't get it perfectly right. We won't be able to always avoid that. To live in this world is to impact others. To simply survive physically, we must eat food. To eat food, we must eat other creatures, or we must eat plants. And although it's perhaps more clear with creatures, if one chooses to eat such food, even plants, actually, if you try to pull them from the soil, they resist. Their whole system is designed to say, actually, no, I don't want to go with you. I want to stay here. Of course, we can overwhelm them because we have tools and strength. But also plants must be sacrificed, in a sense, because life lives on life. It's the only way it happens. And for me to exist, or you, other things must be affected. This is so for us all. But understanding that, we want to take care with what that impact is. Care with what is possible for us in terms of not impacting others. And doing the best we can, which is not according to some model or idea, but just seeing within my life, my capacity, my limitations, to what degree can I protect and preserve the well-being of life? Understanding that the only way I can not have an impact on life is by actually allowing this being to die. And that has an impact on life too. So there's no way out of that. Do you see? No matter what we care for, it will have an impact on. No matter how we care for life, it has an impact. But that sense of keeping the sense of care at the center and doing the best we can to refrain from causing harm, this is one of the fundamental ways of honoring the caring that is at the heart of our life and supporting or establishing a sense of what we could call non-regret, having just done the best we can, is one of the greatest supports for a sense of peace in the heart. And in the Buddha's teaching, he talks about this attention to behavior and action, which we embody in the precepts while here together on retreat. And for many of you, I know, it's also a part of your life, as it is my life, to find ways to live in accordance with that intention. That this is actually something that allows the heart and mind to come more deeply to rest. And all the meditation we do in the world will not bring peace to the heart if we do not also attend to how we live in the world. Because these things are connected profoundly and inextricably. So we're not just engaging with our mind here when we work in meditation. We're engaging with our life through our mind as the doorway. We also need to recognize this caring, the sense of caring that we have, that we care about our life. And I've spoken of this a little already, I think yesterday evening. We care about others and ourselves. There might be others we don't care about so much. That's almost for sure. We'll see those closest to us we care about more. I remember being struck, it was 5 years ago now, when the large and devastating destructive earthquake happened in Christchurch, New Zealand, where I come from or lived very near and went to university. And most of my friends in New Zealand live in the city. And a number of, I think 180, 190 people died in the earthquake. Not any of my friends, fortunately, though most of them had their homes damaged or, in one case, almost destroyed. But I was very struck by how deeply that affected me in comparison to the earthquake that happened just really a few weeks later in Fukushima, Japan, where I've never been and know no one. And thousands upon thousands of people died. And there was massive levels of destruction. And although I was affected, it was less. And it was not troubling, but curious to see, wow, yes, because I know that place more closely, it touches me more deeply. This is natural for us. It is natural for us. But that doesn't mean we don't care about those other places. We just understand what is closer. And of course, this body, one's family, one's community, one's people may feel like primary responsibilities. But our heart can open to include all of life. And the honoring of the caring at the heart of our being, the natural goodness of that. And I don't mean goodness versus badness here. It's not a right and wrong, good versus evil sort of quality. It's more the goodness. There's something wholesome. There's something fundamentally good. What's the other word? I don't know if there is one. About the fact that we care. It says something about what is true in our depth. But equally as we care, we are often asleep to our life and in our life. We see, and shockingly sometimes, how often, how much, and at times how enthusiastically we go to sleep. We seek to escape from the simple conscious encounter with what's here. Sometimes in meditation, I think people are disappointed because they imagine, come and sit down and Siri soon will be calm, clear, bright, you know, ongoingly mindful and hopefully soon enlightened. And what we encounter is a mind that's fragmented, that's reactive, and that is shockingly unenthusiastic at times. about simply being here right now. Because so many other things look more entertaining, more fun, more pleasant, or just simply more constructive and productive. All the things I could try and figure out. And even sometimes we're just not comfortable with having nothing really to do. I used to be surprised and a little disappointed to see that my mind would, sometimes when nothing problematic was happening, would somehow construct elaborate mathematical problems to solve and, you know, work out. Or would carefully add up the exact number of days I'd practiced on retreat over the last 15 years, which shows you how long I went on for. And so just seeing that, noticing that, we're so at one level interested, it may be, in our life, and another level we're not so interested at all. It's important to understand that this unconsciousness is an expression of a blindness. It's sometimes called ignorance, but that in English has a kind of judgmental or pejorative critical quality to it, the word ignorance, like stupid. You have the sense of that? The Buddha spoke of it as not seeing, avidya. And to not see is to inevitably end up banging into things all around us because we don't quite see what's going on. It's not our fault that there is this blindness, this pull towards unconsciousness. It's not our fault, but it is our responsibility. Because we can take responsibility for it and transform it through practice to cultivate mindfulness, awareness, presence, to begin to see clearly into our life, into the experiences, and into the very nature of life itself. The nature of this life as a transformative process. So some of what we notice is our particular patterns, our particular habits, what pulls and pushes us. I wonder, actually I don't really wonder. I like to say that sometimes, so I'm not treating you as if I know what's going on for you or as if I'm, you know, not trying to sit up here looking smart, but actually I don't wonder at all. I'm absolutely confident that for some of you, maybe most of you, at some time, some self-judgment has arisen over the day. Judgment that said, wow, yeah, I'm doing really well. Or, oh no, I'm doing really badly. Or maybe even the judgment that says, oh, I'm doing about the same as everyone else, I think. They're all judgments. They're all evaluations, comparative statements, or statements comparing what we imagine we're measuring about ourselves and what we, again, imagine we're measuring about another. One of the very familiar experiences regularly reported on retreats hasn't been reported to me directly on this retreat, but may well be happening, who knows. We're sitting in meditation, knees are aching. The mind is busy and reactive, or we just feel dull, sleepy, and kind of, what on earth am I doing here? We kind of give up a little bit. It's like, I've had it with this. It's not working. It doesn't work. It's no good. We look around. Everyone else is sitting really quiet, really still. And we suddenly realize, oh my gosh, 90 people in this room, 89 almost fully enlightened Buddhas, and one overcooked vegetable. I might as well give up. There's no point. I'll go home at the end of the sitting. It's a waste of time. And of course the person collapses, gives up, stops looking around. Somebody next door to them opens their eyes, also feeling a bit restless, looks over. Wow, they're not moving. They look really still and peaceful. Wow, they must be doing really deep meditation. So is everybody else. And the story goes on. The story goes on. I was talking with Patel at the beginning of the retreat about bringing this Buddha along. It's the first time I've brought one to Israel. And I know there's not a lot of enthusiasm here for religious imagery. And certainly getting down and bowing to things is a bit, you know, I think for some people here, and not just here, there's a lot of unpleasant things that will be preferable than doing that. But we talked about the way in Gaia House, the retreat centre in England where I live near, we some years ago were given a skeleton. And some people thought this was a bad idea, because although a skeleton is regularly used in Buddhist practice and teaching, Sherid, bones, you know, bones, all the bones of a human being. Yeah? We got it? From a medical student who had no longer the need for them. But it's to reflect on the fact that we're not here forever, to remember that. Kind of useful, but some people don't like them. And yet we reflected, well, of course, that's a bit sort of stark to see a skeleton, but, you know, right now there are probably about 90 skeletons in this room. There are, aren't there? We think about it, of course, we cover with clothing, and then with skin and flesh, but actually, 100 years from now, all these skeletons will be without that. They'll be, well, depending how it goes, you know, different options. But likewise, the Buddha. We put the Buddha here, not just because it's kind of a nice piece of wood from India that I rather enjoy hanging out with, although that's true. I spend a lot of time looking at a lot of Buddhas. They have to have just the right face for me. I'm fussy. And it's not perfect, but it's close enough. And we think maybe, like, you know, Yanai, he's into bowing to Buddhas. I do it every day here, facing this direction that I am now. Just as the skeletons are not obvious to us because we cover them up, so too our awakened nature is not so obvious to us because we haven't learned to see it. We haven't understood what it is that is here at the very heart of our life and what we are. But absolutely, in just the same way, we need reminders to remember that we are not just bodies which will die one day. Although, of course, these bodies will die one day. But we're not just that. And so we watch ourselves, we watch what goes on, we watch this process. Sometimes we see ourselves looking for entertainment, looking around. How many times have you checked the schedule today? We did change it, so I guess it's fair enough that you looked a few times. But when I'm on a retreat, I can read it every time I walk past it. And, you know, it generally doesn't change. But I look at it and go, sitting, walking, standing, sitting. Wow, it's a walker, standing. You know, but we're looking for entertainment so much of the time. I've read the fine print on tea bags, labels, only on retreat. Never at any other time in my life do I read the fine print on the label of a tea bag. But somehow it seems interesting in that situation. We notice how we get hungry for entertainment when the ordinary entertainment isn't there. And how we sometimes are impatient or get bored, frustrated. We want to get away from what's happening. You know, we come to the end of the sitting. Have you noticed what happens when the bell rings sometimes? Like, oh, great. Wow. It's like, I can finish whatever I was doing. But the moment after the bell ring, it's just the same as the moment before. We're still sitting there. We haven't even moved. But suddenly it's like, oh, great. What's changed? Actually, maybe we've given ourselves permission to not have to try and force something that maybe we were trying to force. We'll make the effort to be awake. But of course, the instruction says, be awake while you finish the sitting too, while you're sitting there comfortably or getting up and moving out. But we still think, oh, you know, sitting, 5 minutes to go. You know, 10 minutes later, still 5 minutes to go. You know? Don't look at your watch. It really doesn't help. Don't even bring one in if you can manage it. But then, oh, I can't wait to go walking. Sitting, nah, doesn't work. I go walking, and walking is great for the first few steps on the grass, but after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, oh, I can't wait for the next sitting. Maybe there'll be some standing, you know. 2 minutes into the standing, I want to sit down. We've been here for 10 minutes. We've been here for half an hour. He's forgotten. And the bell rings, we sit down. And we start thinking of lunch. And you know when you get to lunchtime, and it's this really delicious food, and the first 2 or 3 mouthfuls, if you're lucky, And then we start thinking about, I'll have a rest after lunch, or shall I go for a walk, or maybe if I made the trainer, I'd put a little bit more salt and not quite as much lemon juice. And we're gone. We're gone again. Notice how that happens. We don't need to judge it. We need to see it. And sometimes a kindly humor to just be able to chuckle and say, look, look what this mind does. Because that goes on and on and on. That never comes to an end. If we keep thinking that the next thing is going to do it for me, when I get there, we'll arrive with that same belief intact. And when I get there, I'll also look at this place and say, okay, I need to get to the next place. And the next and the next. And as I'm sure, in fact, I know some of you who spoke to me, you know, I can't stand that music, I've got to get out of here, was the response for some. Understandable. But where can you go where there won't be something uncomfortable? There isn't anywhere. You cannot escape from this. But we can learn to meet it. We can open to it. When we learn to let our experience be, learn to be with what is here. We can also then start to see the nature of experience more clearly. See that it's all changing and impermanent, that nothing is fixed and solid. Much of our struggle with the difficult is because we fear that it will become permanent if we do not fight with it. And yet, as one woman described today in the group, she was interested and pleased to discover, and somewhat surprised, that when she didn't push away her thoughts, they actually went away by themselves. Often it's our struggle with what we're afraid of or feel threatened by that actually entangles us in it and sustains it. And likewise, the things we hope that might fulfill or complete us, they cannot last forever. They cannot give us that. Ultimately, there is no lasting satisfaction to be found in things that change. And all things do. If you're not sure about that, just pay attention to them. You'll see. That's part of what we do here. At the same time as nothing, no experience that we could ever have can fulfill us in some permanent way, it's equally true that no experience or circumstance is ultimately an obstacle to our happiness and fulfillment. For exactly the same reasons, they're not forever. And the happiness and fulfillment we seek is not in the things we sometimes mistakenly seek it from. It's not their fault that they can't give it to us. It's because we've misunderstood what the source of it, of the source of what we really are interested in, actually is. So with this, part of what we need to understand is that we come, it seems, from our cultures and our worlds to a view and a position that if I did it perfectly, and if everyone else did it perfectly too, actually everything would feel good all the time. That's not something you might recognize as a thought you have, but if you look at the underlying relationship to pleasant and unpleasant, which says, it should be this, I want more of this, and I should be able to get rid of that, I don't want any of that, that's the underlying position we tend to take. The idea that it would be possible to have things always good, comfortable, pleasant, flattering, pain-free. It's not. The nature of our human body is such that sometimes it experiences what we don't wish for. Likewise, our heart and mind. That's not all there is in life. Of course, there is delight and beauty and joy and can be exquisite fulfillment of a temporary nature through contact with many beautiful things, many nourishing things. But things in themselves are also subject to what the Buddha spoke of as the truth of unsatisfactoriness or dukkha. He spoke of the fact that our body is subject to birth, aging, sickness and death. And in this, it's a difficult journey. We know that. Sometimes our body is uncomfortable. Sitting on a cushion, we might think it's because we're sitting in a funny posture on the floor and we're not supposed to move. But you know, as I said in one of the groups, if you get a really comfortable chair, the most expensive chair you could buy, and you sit up and you really don't move, it gets uncomfortable after a while. But mostly we're not conscious that we're constantly changing position to try and stay comfortable. The momentum of the mental activity that seems like it will never stop is driven to a large degree by our constant attempt to adjust things in the world, in ourself, to get comfortable. And the fact that we keep having to do it and the mind spins in the momentum of that. When we stop doing that so much, it starts to slow down, and given time, it quietens and can actually pause and even come to quiescence, to stillness, to silence. Not by being stopped, but because we're no longer energizing and amplifying the patterns that cause it to spin. And so at a simple bodily level, just acknowledging, oh yeah, sometimes it's uncomfortable. It's okay to change your posture if you need to, but sometimes it's good to just stay with it. Because if we change every time there's a little discomfort, it's a little too hot, let's put on the air conditioning, it's a little too noisy, let's turn it off, all of that, we never come to settle. The Buddha also spoke about the territory of the heart. He spoke of sorrow, pain, grief, lamentation, and despair. It's like we encounter these difficult, painful experiences in our lives. And it's inevitable. There's no way around that. And you might think, well, but if my life went really well, surely it wouldn't have to be sadness or sorrow or loss. But it's not possible. I tell you how it works this way. If you love something or someone in this life, at some point you'll be parted from that person, that thing, that situation, for sure, by accident, by choice, or by death. And that will be painful, that will be grievous, there will be loss and sorrow and distress in that, for sure. And any of you, perhaps many of us, will have lost someone, or certainly we will all have lost something that we loved. One doesn't get that far into a life without that happening. And it hurts, for sure. And the only way to avoid that is if we do not love in this life, if we never love something or someone. And you know, if you never love something or someone, that will hurt. That will feel, that will evoke pain and grief and sorrow. I can't think of a third option. I've often invited people, so hundreds of people have been asked to tell me if they've got one, because it'll be quite nice. But I don't think there is. And it sounds like that's a bit sort of, we could get depressed here, couldn't we? But actually there's something uplifting about acknowledging, of course, that's how it is. That's how it is for us all. It doesn't mean you did it wrong if you experienced these difficult things. It's not your fault. It's not somebody else's fault either. But we can, again, take responsibility for how we hold this. Our life unfolds. Our life unfolds through many conditions, many features and factors, some of which we can influence, others of which we can't. But as we look carefully into this process, we see we don't own it in the way that we imagined. Because to own it would be to suggest we could do what we wanted with it. And the obvious truth of it is, if we look, that we can't. We can't even get our mind to do what we tell it to half the time. We tell it to be quiet. Does it be quiet? Can we tell our mind, oh, I think I'd like to be experiencing happiness and bliss for the next, 15 minutes. It's not too much to ask. I'd like to say for the next 2 or 3, decades. But 15 minutes would be good. But we can't just do it. And that's so close and intimate to us. Did you ever try and get one other person to do what you want all the time? If you don't, take it from me, you don't want to try. Even someone who loves you and who you love, it will just be painful. Because we can't control it, it tells us there's something about our relationship. It's not ours in the way we imagine it to be. This mind, this body, this life. It's something shared. We all have a piece of it. All of us share in it. And as we come closer to and learn to live more intimately in the immediacy of our experience, to be awake in the midst of our life, to be close to the heart of our caring and sensitivity, and to find ways to bring that into our engagement with the world, we start to sense that we are so close to each other and our life and everything around us that we could not imagine or believe ourselves any longer to be separate from everything that is around us, any more than we imagine ourselves separate from what arises within us. At the heart of our life, there is a vastness that includes everything. Everything that we are, everything that we can be, everything that has been and will be, is all in this that is awake and conscious, that is present and here, that cares deeply, because we do, and that is in a process of waking up to see that what we are is not defined or bound by our experience, by what happens. But nor is it separate from our experience and what happens. There's not some other place or thing to go to apart from what's right here. And this has always been so. Will always be so. It doesn't matter how many times we've been lost. As a saying again from India, the light of a single candle will dispel 1,000 years of darkness. We don't need to worry about what has gone. We may still learn from it, but actually let's see what's possible here. What does it mean for us to return to the heart of our life? To trust deeply in what is immediate and what is available, but what also requires us to be willing to include everything, to put nothing outside the circle of our life and of our heart. We can't say what this is, but we can know it directly, or perhaps more, we could say it can know us, and at that point we realize we can say it both ways, and it's exactly the same thing. And in this knowing of the very heart of our life and the resting in it, in the living of it, there's a natural caring and unstoppable kindness and compassion and well-wishing for ourselves, for each other, and for all of life. And it's in this that the heart comes to rest in its own nature, knowing itself as it is, knowing everything included within that. So let's just sit quietly together for a moment or two. So may we all in our practice here together and in our lives, may we have the courage and the trust to enter so deeply into this life, in the heart of our life, to include all things within this, and to awaken in that very heart, as that very heart of life, for our own well-being, for the welfare of all beings and all that lives.